Welcome to Banfield. We begin tonight with two stories. The one that Jussie Smollett told Chicago police back in January of 2019 and still to this day insists is true. And the story of Smollett himself, which culminates tonight in five guilty verdicts of felony disorderly conduct. Because that story back in 2019 was a lie. A lot of lies, in fact. Each of them amounting to a false police report, which is a crime. The actor and singer who shot to fame in the TV series Empire could face 3 years in prison on each of those counts, all arising from his claims of having been the victim of a racist and homophobic street crime. The story he told brought him nationwide attention and broad support until police decided that story didn't add up and Jussie was charged with staging the whole thing. But then something very weird happened. Those charges were dropped for reasons that still aren't completely clear. And it took a special prosecutor many months later to reinvestigate and bring new charges and go to trial. And thus, here we are tonight. Guilty. Five times over guilty. I am joined by one of my very favorite defense attorneys, Trent Copeland, who is a veteran legal analyst and civil rights trial lawyer. Also one of my very favorite prosecutors, Stacey Honowitz of Florida State Attorney's Office, and also from the PR/crisis management trenches, the founder and CEO of the firm Red Banyan, Evan Nierman. Welcome to all of you. Trent Copeland, I'm going to begin with you because you are a lawyer. I wanted to know if you thought what happened today was going to happen today or if you were surprised at all.
I thought what was going to happen today was a good thing, frankly, and I wasn't surprised at all, Ashley. I think this jury turned away from what I think Jussie Smollett would have wanted, and that was jury nullification. He wanted this jury to look away at every single fact that was presented in this case, because every single fact in this case pointed towards his guilt. I think Jussie Smollett was found guilty on all five of those charges, should have been found guilty on even the six. But frankly, you know, look, this is what should have happened. This is justice. This is justice at work. I think what he did was an abomination to the justice system. I think it took 130,000 monetary damages to Chicago, 30 police off the streets. I think he got every bit of what he deserved.
Well, they were lucky that the special prosecutor didn't charge any money for his services. I was sort of gobsmacked when I found out that he had just done it all pro bono. And I thought, well, I don't know if I've heard of a special prosecutor doing that before when it's, you know, government money. But Stacey, let me ask you as a prosecutor, that last thing that Trent said was important. There was that last sixth charge, right, which the jury decided he was not guilty of. And the defense attorney was very quick to say, oh, that's inconsistent. That's an inconsistent verdict and, you know, this and that. I've seen inconsistent verdicts before. I find them uncomfortable, but I don't find them sort of like reversible or appellate issues or anything.
Well, I mean, the defense attorney came out with guns blazing, basically saying that his client is 100% innocent and he's going to win on appeal. And if you look at the fact that the sixth count was kind of discarded, it meant that it was inconsistent and the jury thought a different way. And that's really not how you look at it. That sixth count happened 2 weeks after the initial five counts. Why the jury decided to find him not guilty on that, we'll never know. But it's almost like a throwaway count, as the prosecutor came out and said, listen, it doesn't affect our case one bit. And as far as him doing it for free, he made it very clear, listen, I'm doing this as justice for the city. I took a good look at this, and I know what our city went through, the racial divides, what happened, the amount of manpower that was used, the taking away from other victims, real victims of crimes. And that's why this prosecutor came out and said, I'm not taking any money for it. We can disregard that sixth count. It had no bearing on this case whatsoever.
Okay, I want to run a quick soundbite of the defense attorney because, like you said, Stacey, guns blazing. He came out and he addressed a big scrum of reporters saying 100% and appeal, and this he'll be vindicated and all the rest. His name is Nihai Uche, and here he is just like, I think, within the last hour or two. Take a look.
We're obviously very disappointed. We obviously respectfully disagree with the jury's verdict. The verdict is inconsistent. You cannot say Jussie's lying and Jussie's not lying for the same exact incident. So we feel 100% confident that this case will be won on appeal.
So, okay, that could happen. I'm never going to say never. But, Evan, the lying part. I remember covering the case of a young woman in Florida who was an exquisite liar. And the whole country hated her because she was such a liar. Her name was Casey Anthony. And it didn't matter that later some of the charges went away. She's still as hated as ever because she's a liar. There's something about lying, you know, especially in the PR business, that you just can't get past, can you?
Absolutely. Once you lie and you've shown that you are not a trustworthy source, who's going to ever believe anything that you have to say? So in this case, Jussie Smollett, when he came out with this fantastical claim of what happened to him, he initially got a lot of support. Folks in Hollywood were lining up, expressing their sentiments of support for him and were outraged by this attack. But then we find that the whole thing was a complete hoax. It was made up. And essentially what Jussie Smollett has done here is not just to totally derail his credibility, to self-immolate his career, to remove all prospects of future Hollywood success, but he's also done a real disservice to legitimate victims of hate crimes and attacks, because now he set this precedent where someone would actually go to the links to make something like this up, and it does a real disservice to the people who actually will need help and deserve sympathy and support down the road, because he's now created this unbelievable situation where someone actually made this up.
So, Trent, if you watch cable news, it's like amazing. You know, one channel over on the left just won't even cover this at all. And then a channel over here on the right is like wall to wall, and it's all about racism, and there's no racism and whatever, right? But when it comes right down to it, the judge has discretion in sentencing in this case. And I'm kind of wondering if the judge feels the polarizing, you know, aspects of this case, if he feels the culture of the country, if he's, you know, wants to be reelected. All that comes into his humanity. But at the same time, he has to follow the law. But discretion is a funky little animal.
You know, discretion is important. And I want to comment just a little bit ago, our last guest said that Hollywood lined up in support of Jussie Smollett. But it wasn't just Hollywood. It was also political leaders. Joe Biden lined up in support of Kamala Harris lined up in support of him. And I think there were a lot of people who felt like this was something that we needed to get behind. Because remember, let's put this in context, Ashley. This came just a few years after Sandra Bland's killing, the hands of white police, Philando Castile, Walter Scott, our country was under tinderbox. And for him to take advantage of this situation, for him to do what he did and to make the kind of claims that he made, particularly using the same kind of racial tropes and stereotypes that have such historical consequence in our country, those are all really difficult things for people to understand. And I think the judge, when he's exercising that discretion that you refer to, Ashley, I think the judge will consider those things. What he has done, what Jussie Smollett did to sort of hijack and disenfranchise people who are otherwise victims of racial violence, racial injustice, racial hate crimes, for him to hijack that for his own illegitimate purposes, I think a judge has to consider. And if this judge is able to give him, to throw the book at him and give him the most that he can, it's frankly only limited to 1 year. But I think the judge, Ashley, as you described a moment ago, when he exercises that really important word, discretion, I think his discretion will be based on what he saw in that courtroom, not based on the political factors, not based on the pressures, not based on the equities outside of the courtroom, but based on what he saw in that courtroom, which I think we can all agree was outrageous.
Well, you're so much better at explaining that than I could ever be, probably because you have a law degree. I don't. But I also think that judges move with the times, right? I mean, they're reflective of the community. They're elected by the community, and some norms are different now than they were back then. And so I sometimes wonder if a little bit of that isn't imbued into them as they make these decisions and they exercise their discretion. But I guess in the same way, Stacey, the prosecutor originally decided she was going to dump these charges. I suppose that's her discretion, right? Kim Fox. And now everybody's zeroing in on her, saying, oh, she's going to go under the microscope. What do you think is in store for Kim Fox in all of this?
Well, it wasn't a matter of she wanted to dump. She did dump them, and she did it very secretly. If you remember way back, I mean, they went into the courtroom very early. It was kind of under the cover of night that this was done. But interestingly enough, she was reelected after this all took place. Now, in looking back, of course, everyone is thinking to themselves, what did she do? And that's why the special prosecutor came in, because he was appointed by the court to look into this as to why, when there was overwhelming evidence, she decided to do this. I don't know if we'll ever know why she did it. I don't know if back at that time they did try to investigate when she took herself out of it afterwards. But the fact of the matter is, we're dealing with the situation now. That's behind us. The special prosecutor came in, took this case, reviewed the evidence, and went to a jury and had a jury make this decision. Knew that the evidence was there. And although I think the judge, of course, will use his discretion, you know, in the courtroom, he has to look at everything that's gone on. This man took the stand for days and lied and lied and lied. And this jury went back in 9 hours and discredited everything this person had to say. It's very difficult after you've been convicted and after you've taken the stand and said all these things and the jury has disregarded what you said, to then go in front of the judge and kind of say, I'm sorry, because basically you've told a completely different story. So the judge takes all of that into consideration. Also, if you remember, some of the reports came out that the judge was not very happy with the way that he was answering questions. Not that that means that the judge says, I think he's answering improperly, but he refused to answer. He said, I don't want to answer yes or no. So all of these things are taken into consideration. And I don't think in this time, this judge is really going to worry about, if I don't give him prison, am I going to get reelected? Or if I give him prison, am I going to get reelected? The times are changing. The nation was all over this case. This was a heinous crime. It wasn't just lying to the police. It had a nation up in arms. And I think that's what the court has to look at.
Okay, so, Evan, you know, I tend to think about this whole idea of appeal, right? Because the defense attorney said, we're going to appeal 100%, you know, not guilty and all the rest. And I go back to OJ. He beat the rap in the criminal trial. Let's not talk about the civil part that followed, but just on the criminal stuff, he beat the rap. He's a not guilty guy of murder. But if you think about OJ's brand, it is awful. I mean, most people think he's a murderer. Most people use the term, you know, erroneously murderer. So even if Jussie Smollett does appeal and finds a way to beat the rap next time round, this thing's pretty ugly, and it's got a lot of people really, you know, aggro about it. Do you think he could fix this? Do you think he could un-OJ himself?
No, he definitely can't, because even by taking this to trial and then taking the stand, he'd already lost. He has lost. He's lost credibility, and the verdict just cements his fate even further. This is a loser for him. If he would have had a possibility of reinventing himself, if he would have said, look, this is what happened. I admit I made it up. It wasn't true. It was a terrible mistake. It was unlikely that he could recover from that, but there was at least a sliver of a possibility. Now that's been completely erased. He got on the stand. A jury of his peers decided that he lied and lied and lied some more. He lied to the police. He lied to the public. There's no coming back from this. I'm sorry. It's game over. What took a beating here was not Jussie Smollett. It was his credibility and ultimately his career.
Yeah, so I just want to play one quick moment from the guy who, by the way, again, I had a total jaw drop moment. I don't know about you guys, but this special prosecutor, he told the reporters that, you know, when they asked him how much he's getting paid, he said nothing. It was pro bono. He did this for free. He offered to do it for free, even though it would be a government paycheck, right? So I thought that was impressive to start with. But here's what he had to say outside after he basically won 5 out of 6. Take a look.
Defendants have a right to go to trial. Defendants have a right to argue that their case has not been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. But defendants do not have the right to go in front of a jury and lie under oath. Mr. Smollett would not have lost this case, as he did today, unless the jury found that he lied to them.
Okay, so Trent, I'm going to ask you this. You know, it's fun. Everybody says, well, will he be charged with perjury? Yeah. Probably not. But I think that whole business about taking the risk of getting up on the stand and, you know, trying to defend yourself. If it's a gamble and you lose and the jury says you're guilty, then you're also a liar when it comes to sentencing. Right. Do you think that the judge is going to bring down the hammer on Jussie Smollett and say, you're going to spend all 3 years of the max on this one, plus, I think, $25,000 in fines or something? Do you think he's going to do it all?
I don't think that he'll do it all. And the only reason, Ashley, is because Jussie Smollett does not have a criminal record of any kind. So if the judge has any ability to deviate from giving him the maximum sentence, I think he probably will. I think the judge will also take into account that Jussie Smollett has been humiliated. Jussie Smollett has been sort of, you know, torn to pieces in terms of the public. So I think the judge will give him as much as he can reasonably give him. I don't know that it'll be all 3 years. I think he'll probably run these sentences concurrent. But I think Jussie Smollett's going to see the inside of a jail cell. And I think every bit of that has been earned.
I see it as a concurrent, too, because this was one act, one lie that went to two guys. That last one, which is interesting, that the one where the jury said not guilty was 2 weeks later. That was another incident where I could see a consecutive sentence if he was guilty. But on this one, one incident, so a concurrent. So, you know, if he goes for the max, it would be three. But interesting to hear you say he's already been humiliated. I didn't really thought of that one. Trent, you're so smart. All right, thank you. Trent, I know you have other stuff you got to get to, so I'm going to say goodbye to you and invite you back anytime, early and often. Thank you, Trent Copeland.
Thank you.
Stacey's going to stay with us. Evan, you're going to come back a little later in the show as well. Don't go anywhere if I can ask you. From one big trial moment to another one, we are nearing the end of the long-awaited sex trafficking trial of Jeffrey Epstein's right-hand lady. And that in itself is news. The trial only started 10 days ago, and it was expected to take several weeks, but prosecutors kind of like dropped a bombshell. They stunned the reporters in the viewing room by announcing, we're probably going to wrap this baby up tomorrow, at least our part of it. And that's weeks before expected, at which point Ghislaine Maxwell's got a big decision to make, massive, whether or not to take the stand and try, in her own words, to convince the jury that she is not the person prosecutors say she is. That, despite a trove of never-before-seen photographic evidence and sometimes graphic emotional testimony, she knew nothing about the rampant sexual abuse of underage girls by the man to whom she devoted her entire adult life. Right there, snuggling up, hanging out on his yacht. One of those photographs, Government Exhibit 347, if you're counting, stands out for no reason other than the setting. It could be a rustic cabin, but it happens to belong to this lady, the one and only Queen of England, whose favorite son, Prince Andrew, used to hang out with Epstein and Maxwell. That was them snuggling in the very same spot where the Queen likes to hang out in the sun on the porch in that log cabin. Ew. Andrew has already been mentioned three times in this trial, currently being sued by the woman in this photograph, who is also a key accuser of Epstein. I am going to stop here, and I'm going to let my experts do the talking right after the break. Jeffrey Epstein's girlfriend slash alleged accomplice on the witness stand? I suppose it could happen, right? And maybe even sooner than we thought. I'm joined again by Stacey Honowitz from the Sex Crimes and Child Abuse Unit of the Florida State Attorney's Office. Also with Hillary Fordwich, a business consultant and official royal watcher. And Josh Schiffer, who's an Atlanta-based lawyer, whose firm represents another of Epstein's alleged victims. Welcome all. Okay, Hillary, I'm going to start with you. I couldn't believe it when I saw the picture. I had never seen it before, and I don't think many of us had. A picture of Jeffrey Epstein snuggling with Ghislaine Maxwell in the cozy cabin. Let's put it up on the screen, because it might have gone unnoticed, except for the fact that there's another picture of the Queen of England snuggling up in that exact same corner of the little cabin on, you know, the grounds of Balmoral Castle. And I can only think that the Queen was probably pretty upset to see the headlines comparing that picture to the picture where she's sitting in the same spot.
Well, pleasure to be back with you, Ashley, and you're absolutely right. The photograph is extremely damning, except that if you look very closely, you will see in the background that there's different backgrounds. One has a field that, or sort of a large, long lead up to hills behind it and gorse bushes, and the other one doesn't. One has close trees and the other one doesn't. The photograph of the Queen, she's actually sitting next to Margaret Rhodes. There's more than one cabin on Balmoral property. One is by the River Dee and the other one is in Glenbog, which is a tributary to the River Dee. So there's not only one cabin, but yes, they're all designed very similarly, and so it does look rather similar, to say the very least, in a similar position. But no matter what, as we've talked before about the court of public opinion, this is ghastly. And this is something, you're absolutely right, that neither the Queen nor anyone in the royal family should ever have to face. And it's rather dreadful that Prince Andrew has brought this down upon his ailing mother.
I'll bet. Well, maybe she doesn't know. If she's ailing right now, maybe they're shielding her from this. But I love the way you say ghastly.
No. She knows.
You really think so?
She knows.
Really? Mm-hmm. Oh, man, I kind of wish that she didn't, because I'd like her to have some peace. This isn't her fault, any of it. Okay, so Stacey, the lovey-dovey business about Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein smooching and yachting and foot rubbing and all these gross things, so that would be normal for a couple. I guess it shows that they're a close couple. Okay, I get it. We already knew they were boyfriend-girlfriend for a short time, but I don't think she's his type. But does it matter otherwise, unless she says to the court, I barely knew the guy?
Well, I think she's kind of taken that stance, you know, even though we haven't heard it in the courtroom, we've heard it kind of outside, that she really didn't have that kind of relationship with him. So certainly any kind of evidence that shows them canoodling and together and all of these hugging and kissing shows the court, shows the jury, wait a second, this relationship is pretty tight. She must know everything that's going on with him. And remember, Ashley, it's not just the photographs that show them together. You had live testimony of these women that came forward and said, she brought me into the fold. She basically interviewed me. She kind of seduced me to meet him. She brought me to the house. It was kind of set up in the way that she wanted me to work for him. And so any kind of relationship that shows them being that close corroborates what the prosecution is trying to say, that she knew and she conspired and she agreed with him to traffic these girls. So yes, it does make a difference. It certainly corroborates what these girls had to say about the relationship between her and Epstein.
It's so odd when you look at pictures like that. And Josh, I wonder, you know, if your lawyer mind starts ticking, her defense is going to start. And I could understand if they stood up and said to this jury, what girlfriend of Jeffrey Epstein would ever want to bring in another one and bring in loads and loads of other ones? If she loves them this much as she does in these photographs, how on earth could she possibly want to be, you know, trafficking other girls into the relationship? Is that viable, or are jurors smart enough to know people can be kinky?
I think jurors are really sophisticated about whether people walk outside the boundaries of traditional relationships. And think about what else has been talked about in this trial. Mr. Epstein is being accused of, when a young lady turns 18, she's suddenly getting too old. And I think it's very reasonable for the state to argue, and it's something the defense is going to have to deal with, about the fact that Ghislaine and Mr. Epstein certainly had an incredibly intimate relationship by acknowledgement. And that relationship changed dramatically over time. And what the government's witnesses have come up and testified is that Ghislaine's relationship was so intimate, she went beyond what a girlfriend would do and became his fixer, his groomer. And that's really the core of the government's case right now. And that's certainly what the testimony of these young women, which has just been gripping. And it's impossible for a juror to look away from actual legitimate emotion. Jurors have great noses to smell lies and fakery and trickery. They're super sensitive to it. And as for everything I've heard, the testimony of these young women has been absolutely authentic, that Ghislaine was involved in acquiring, finding, grooming, and presenting these young women to Mr. Epstein until
we'll say,
he was done with them.
You know, I will say that the cross-examinations have been really strong, almost to the point where there's been a lot of criticism, not almost, definitely to the point where there's been a lot of criticism of the prosecutors for not preparing their witnesses better for a withering cross-examination. Hillary, let me get this one to you, because there's another criticism, and that is that the prosecutors have had all sorts of, you know, former co-conspirators or alleged co-conspirators from the 2007 plea deal. They could have paraded them up and onto the stand to talk about Ghislaine Maxwell. They could have paraded Virginia Roberts Giuffre, who is the Prince Andrew accuser, up and onto the stand. And I think there's some dissatisfaction with the idea that the public could have learned a little more about Jeffrey Epstein's freak behavior. But because the prosecutors didn't bring those witnesses, we may not. What do you make of that? Because especially your connection to the royal case.
Well, you're absolutely right about that. I will say that regardless of her testifying or not, and of course she's not testifying, nevertheless, a lot of what is talked about, a lot of the witnesses, a lot of these women that are being interviewed are actually bound to corroborate the many visits that Prince Andrew did make to that island. So it's damning just in the very lack of even her presence, what other people may say, and also the testimony of the telecommunications specialist who's already said that he's seen Prince Andrew there. I think that what is really also very dreadful is that Prince Andrew, of course, denies really even remembering Virginia Giuffre or much of it. And now we know from a lot of the three different mentions that have already taken place at the trial that these mentions actually indicate that he was there to a greater extent than he has testified, or not testified, but that he was in his interview with the BBC with Emily that he's even talked to so far. So it's actually contradicted
so
his previous testimony.
I think we're going to be talking again real soon because the case continues. Hillary, Josh, and Stacey, thank you to all three of you. Much appreciated for your wisdom.